soon to be. My wonderful mentor is here, Dr. Ellen Daly, who will be giving me my PhD at one point someday. So I want to start off by thanking her. I'm a doctoral candidate at University of South Florida, and today I'm going to be talking about barriers to achieving routine HPV vaccination among young MSM. First, I want to ask a question, though. How many of you know that HPV is a sexually transmitted infection? Okay, good. So I don't have to spend a lot of time on that. And how many of you know that the HPV vaccine is currently licensed for use in males? Perfect. I told you I didn't have to talk about that. So I don't have anything to disclose. And instead of talking about HPV ad nauseum, I'm just going to get right to the meat of it so I have more time to talk about the data. So there are significant health disparities that we see in HPV infection, primarily among MSM. And at the forefront of that is really anal cancer. And this is data that looks at anal cancer incidence rates per 100,000 person years of the general population for men and women. So you see it's a relatively rare cancer compared to other cancers. Now, think about, you all know that cervical cancer, people think about HPV and cervical cancer. The incidence rate of that is about 8 per 100,000. So you see that anal cancer is relatively rare in the population. But when we look at MSM and we look at HIV-negative MSM, you see it's significantly higher. And the confidence interval for this ranges up to 30 per 100,000, which exceeds the rate of cervical cancer prior to PAP testing. So it's a significant disparity that MSM face with anal cancer rates. And when you look at HIV-positive MSM, it's kind of off the charts in compared to the other people, and that's because of the immunosuppression. So, okay, you can't really see that very well. There are multiple types of HPV, but the ones that we're concerned about in terms of cancer risk are what we call high-risk HPV. It's about a handful of them. And they're responsible for about 80% of all anal cancers, and it's almost 99% of cervical cancer. So it's highly relevant, but it's highly prevalent in MSM. And these are prevalence rates of anal cancer by HIV negative, so that's 37.2% point prevalence of a current anal cancer or anal HPV infection in HIV negative men. And it's up to 73.5% in HIV positive men. So this is a very prevalent infection that we see in this population. The good news is that we have a vaccine that is both safe and effective at preventing four types of HPV. So type 6 and 12, or 6 and 11, are responsible for most cases of genital warts. But 16 and 18, and primarily 16, are responsible for the vast majorities of anal cancer that we see. And these are the types that Gardasil currently does vaccinate for. It's a three-dose series given over 6 months. And these are the recommendations of how this is unfolded. Oftentimes we think about HPV as a women's health issue, and the men in my sample kind of reiterated that finding. But as far as back as 2009 is when the FDA licensed Gardasil for use in men. And it was given a permissive use for 9 to 26-year-old men. And it was indicated for the prevention of genital warts. Then in 2010, after seeing sort of the growing body of literature that we find about its importance for anal cancer prevention, they indicated it for anal cancer prevention, which is a big deal. In 2011, Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices at the CDC recommended, that instead of just a permissive use, they actually made a recommendation for the use of the HPV vaccine in all men up through age 21. But they did something different, and they did a special indication for the use of the vaccine in MSM up through age 26. So you see a five-year difference between these recommendations, which is great, but I feel like there's going to be implementation issues related to that. When we look at how this vaccine is being uptake by the population, it's very low. In 2010, 2% of males 9 to 17 years old had initiated at least one dose of the vaccine. Now remember, this is a three-dose, so this is even looking at completion. And in 2011, 11% of males 11 to 17, but only 6% of adult males who were vaccine eligible. And when we look at MSM as recent as last year, only 5% of MSM 18 to 26 have received one dose of the HPV vaccine. So this is a cohort of men who aren't going to be vaccinated as children because they're already past that vaccine age, and they can highly benefit from the vaccine. So there's really two barriers that I see in implementation of this recommendation. And the first is that healthcare providers really need to recommend this vaccine to their MSM patients. up through age 26. So if they're just seeing males, they may stop at 21 and stop recommending the vaccine if they're not having discussions about sexual behavior or sexual orientation with their patients. And we saw from a paper that's in press now that collects data of last year that only 11% of MSM have received a healthcare provider's recommendation. So this really isn't going to cut it in terms of a mass wide use uptake intervention. The other issue that could happen is that we require MSM to actually seek out and ask for this themselves. And this is really the focus of what my dissertation research is on. And this brings in issues of sexual orientation disclosure and behaviors. And that's the purpose of this study, was to explore how these issues surrounding sexual orientation may act as actual barriers to achieving this recommendation. And this is a two-part study. The first part was a quantitative study that I did in 2010, and the main research question was, how do perceived disclosure of sexual orientation or behaviors relate to HPV vaccine intentions? And how do young gay and bisexual men describe their perceptions and experiences with disclosure in healthcare settings? So that's study two. Just real briefly, study one was in 2010, so it was a web-based quantitative survey. I recruited the sample through student organizations in the Southwest United States and using social networking sites. And this was a structured instrument where I measured self-efficacy in obtaining the HPV vaccine and also beliefs about disclosure. And I'll talk more about that in a second. In study two, which I just completed, were individual in-depth interviews with a population that I recruited similarly, but I kept it local to the Tampa Bay area. They were mostly in-person interviews, and it was just an open-ended discussions about healthcare and healthcare experiences as well as HPV. Just briefly, some of the demographics. These are men aged 18 to 26. They could have identified it as gay or bisexual, but they didn't have to actually have had sex yet, because really that's the target population that we want before they've actually initiated sexual intercourse. But most of them have had sexual intercourse. I was purposely sampling ethno-racial minorities in study two, and also those who were HIV infected to see if this represents a different population in terms of health education. And they were primarily students, and a few of them had already graduated college. So for study one results, as could be expected, when asked, have you ever talked to a healthcare provider about getting the HPV vaccine, the vast majority of them had not. And this is pretty early on, so that's not a big surprise, but as I showed the data earlier, it was still about the same as late as last year, so this really hasn't changed much. And I asked them, would you get the vaccine in the next year if a healthcare provider recommended it? And they're overwhelmingly accepting of this vaccine. We see this in all of the acceptability studies. There's not huge lack of acceptability or intentions to receive this vaccine. So what's really the barrier are structural barriers I'm going to talk about. And when you ask them how likely they are, their intention to ask a healthcare provider about the HPV vaccine, it's kind of a mixed bag. Half of them said that they would be likely to talk about this. And keep in mind that these are people who just completed a survey where I ask knowledge questions and then I provide information. So it acts as a type of intervention. So I think the actual number of this would be quite smaller. But you have as many as almost 20% who said that they probably wouldn't talk to their healthcare provider or that they were unsure. So the two items of interest for this presentation was the belief question, I would feel uncomfortable discussing the HPV vaccine with a healthcare provider if I had to answer questions about my sexual orientation. So in the context, if they're over the age of 21 and a healthcare provider is just routinely recommending the vaccine for that age range and not talking about sexual behavior, then they may have to actually talk about their sexual behavior, say, hey, I would like the HPV vaccine, I'm within the recommended age range or whatever. And I did find that almost 30% of the samples did say that they would feel uncomfortable doing this. And when we look at an even stronger predictor of intention, are you kidding? Oh my God, I got to hurry up. How confident are you in your ability to do the HPV vaccine? We saw about a quarter of them felt that they weren't confident at all. So now I'm going to go in overdrive here for a second. Are you joking?
No, that's not kidding.
So when I just looked at the correlations, the basic bivariate correlations between these variables, I did find that discomfort in discussing sexual behavior with a healthcare provider was related to lower self-efficacy in getting vaccinated for HPV, which in turn decreased intentions to ask their provider about it. So we see that this is a huge barrier, and there was some small relationship with just discomfort and intentions. So I really wanted to explore this idea of how they felt confident and why they felt confident. So I did this qualitative study And I identified three main categories, which I labeled Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which is about the relevancy of these discussions that they felt. We come from opposite ends of the earth, which is sort of the disparity between the patient and the provider and how they felt that they didn't really understand the unique healthcare needs of gay men. And also, sometimes you want to go where no one knows your name. And those were about privacy and anonymity concerns. So when I asked them, what do you think about talking to a healthcare provider about their sexual behavior orientation, they talked about it not being relevant to the discussion. So a lot of the men talked about, if you're having sex, you're having sex. It doesn't matter if I'm having sex with two men or two women. It's sex. We're at the same risk. So they're really not thinking a lot about prevalence of certain infections that we're concerned about and how your risk increases by the population and the type of sexual behaviors. So they didn't really, they almost were offended by asking these questions, and the way in which the questions were asked, a lot of them described as probing and just too much. So they didn't think it was relevant. And at times they became guarded and selective about how they answered, or they just flat out lied. So in the case of Marvin, he felt that he was stigmatized. He was there seeing his healthcare provider about a non-sexual related issue, but they were asking about sexual behavior, and he was assuming that they assumed that he was promiscuous. So there was this stigmatization that he perceived his provider thought that gay males were promiscuous. When I asked them, I was getting these questions a lot, so I just started asking them how they felt about talking to their healthcare provider. A lot of the emotions were about shame. They felt ashamed that I'm going to be embarrassed or ashamed that my healthcare provider thinks I'm too promiscuous. They felt awkward in sitting there telling a heterosexual or a perceived heterosexual male about their sexual behaviors that they can't identify with. And they also were worried about their preconceived notions about what it means to be gay and what that relates to their, and how that relates to their behaviors. And Carlos described feeling judged. He, I guess, perceived his healthcare provider as a staunch Republican, old white guy who was very different from him as a Puerto Rican gay kid. And so this kind of underlined how he felt like he's not going to really understand me and have what I had to say, so I'd rather not say anything about it at all. So when I think about, when I ask them what they think about actually talking to the about HPV and the vaccine with their healthcare providers, again, this idea of we come from opposite ends of the earth, they felt that they would be biased and not competent in even talking about HPV. As Brandon indicated, that he didn't think his provider would even know about HPV, and if he did, that they wouldn't know about the special indications for MSM and the unique benefit that MSM can confer from it. And Jamal talked about he would feel comfortable if he could assess how his provider's views about or attitudes towards sexual minorities in general. So he'd be okay with talking about it as long as he felt that it was a warm and welcoming environment. So when I asked them then, where do you go to receive sexual health services, even though they may have a primary care physician and see them on a regular basis, they seek out sexual health services in alternate ways. So they go to the public health department, where Brian described that this is a place where he doesn't, and this may be a bad thing, doesn't build rapport, never sees the same person twice, so he doesn't care about the judgment because he doesn't see them, he won't see them again. So there's a sense of anonymity. And Gary said that and a lot of these guys, they're younger guys, so a lot of times they're seeing their pediatricians still or their family physicians, and they didn't want to talk about these issues in fear that it's going to get back to their families eventually. So the main message here from this data is LGBT health centers. They all described them as being very accepting and welcoming, and they felt comfortable receiving the vaccine at them as well as preferring to get the vaccine at them because – I'm almost done. Okay, this is a good part. Because they perceive them as being trusting sources, they are non-judgmental and welcoming places. And they were already, and my sample may be unique, but they were already going for regular HIV testing and at regular intervals. And they expressed, like Chad said, he didn't really have a lot of motivation necessarily to go get the vaccine, but he would get it during his regular testing visits if it was offered to him. So my recommendations from this data would be to offer the vaccine at alternative settings. So if we can change policies and procedures in order to be able to vaccinate these guys while they're going for their HIV testing, then I feel we'd reach out to a lot more of them. And cultural competence training, the Institute of Medicine recommended this, and I think it would probably be helpful in this regard, but you have to change their perceptions of their providers as well. One more. And policy change would be the last. So there's lots of reasons of the policy, but it would be easier if we had a standard vaccine policy for HPV and say, let's vaccinate everyone up to age 26, and then we don't have to worry about this issue at all. And here are my acknowledgments.
And since the soon-to-be Dr. Weldon used up There's time. There's no time for questions.
Sorry. I'll be around later. I don't think you gave me 15 minutes.
No, I did. Yeah, totally. We have time for a couple questions. Just for anyone have something dying to get out. Go ahead.
I have a question. I know you said this when you were talking very quickly, but can you talk a little bit more about how you recruited your sample, one, and then also, because I'm trying to clarify my mind with this sort of a clinic-based sample, like, mm-hmm. Have they already been seen there?
The qualitative part? I tried to collect through clinics, but it didn't actually work out well.
Yeah.
So I collected data through local school-based LGBT groups,
okay.
And then on Grindr.
Okay.
So and some of the other apps. So I would actually go on there and recruit directly, and I had a lot of success from recruiting pretty quickly for guys that would be willing to come and talk to me.
And so I guess my question: did you also ask when they were last seen by a medical provider?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't actually include any of those statistics here, but I did ask. And I asked in depth about that last experience and also their first experience of talking about their sexual orientation, which is where a lot of those quotes came from.
Thank you. Christopher.